It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to another harrowing installment of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight we bring you a tale of two extremes. One that will leave you burning from the inside out, and another that will bury you in the merciless cold. Fire and ice, heat and hunger, the biting chill of being watched in the frozen dark. No matter the temperature, tonight's stories will leave you breathless, if they don't take your breath away completely. Before we begin, I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us. If you enjoy what we do, be sure to leave us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And if you're watching us on YouTube, hit that thumbs up, drop us a comment, and subscribe. Don't forget to ring that bell so you never miss a story. Want to take your love for horror even further? Head on over to ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and become a patron. For just $7.99 a month or even less with an annual subscription, you'll unlock ad-free content, exclusive stories, and early access to the horrors yet to come. And while you're at it, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X for behind-the-scenes updates, community discussions, and even the chance to influence future episodes. Now, sit back, relax if you dare, and let's turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first story tonight comes from the mind of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights founder, Craig Groshek. Crafted from an idea originally sparked by his oldest son, Corbin. Some people chase heat. They climb the Scoville scale like mountaineers, seeking out the next challenge, the next rush, the next burn. But sometimes, there's a reason the heat is off limits. Sometimes the flames don't stop when the food is gone. Sometimes the fire doesn't stay in your mouth. Performed by Christopher Drappe, making his Chilling Tales debut, and featuring Kevin Barbary, this is The Heat Pyramid by Craig Groshek.
Some things you see, you can't unsee. No matter how hard you try. I've spent months replaying that afternoon in my head, asking myself if it was even real. But every time I close my eyes, I remember Donovan. What happened to him? How fast it all spiraled out of control. And the worst part? I can still smell the burnt flesh. Like it's soaked into my brain and refuses to leave. It happened on a Friday afternoon, a few blocks from our high school. Donovan and I were walking home like we always did, kicking rocks down the sidewalk and talking about the usual stuff. Video games, girls we had crushes on, and the spicy ramen we tried last weekend. We've been obsessed with spicy food for years. Like those weirdos who ask for hot sauce gift sets at Christmas. Donovan was even more hardcore than me. He kept one of those mini bottles of ghost pepper sauce on his keychain, just to flex. So when we saw the cart, it was like the universe was testing us. It was sitting at the corner of Blake and 6th, where the hardware store used to be, before it closed. The thing looked way too professional to just be a random food stand, sleek black panels, shiny chrome trim, and banners with block letters, climb the heat pyramid. There was a colorful chart plastered to the side, showing all the peppers you'd expect. Jalapeno, habanero, ghost pepper, Carolina Reaper, and the new champion of heat, Pepper X. But above those were even more levels. Names I didn't recognize. Like Sun's Wrath and Devil's Grin. There were at least 10 more levels beyond what should have been physically possible. I should have known right then that something was off. But the vendor? Man, he was smooth. He had the whole Carnival of Barker vibe down to a science. Grinning wide, gesturing dramatically, and calling us over with the promise of a new sensation.
"Come on, gentlemen, how tough are those taste buds? Care to test your limits?"
he said with a grin.
"Today's your lucky day. Free samples, all heat, no charge."
Donovan's eyes lit up.
"Free? Absolutely. You just gotta prove you can climb the pyramid."
The vendor's grin was way too wide, like cartoon character wide.
"Think you've got what it takes?"
I felt a knot in my stomach. I wanted to say no, but Donovan was already walking toward the cart, like a moth to a flame. I couldn't just stand there, so I followed. The vendor handed us each a sample. A weird, puffy chip that looked like someone combined a Cheeto with a potato chip. It was dusted in bright red powder that smelled dangerous.
"This one's jalapeno, baby stuff,"
the vendor said, winking.
"Let's see if you can make it to the top."
We popped them into our mouths and the heat hit instantly. It wasn't anything we couldn't handle, just a warm-up. But it was sharp, like the heat wanted to crawl into your gums and nest there. Donovan grinned and gave the vendor a thumbs up.
"That's all you've got?"
Donovan teased, because of course he did. The vendor laughed.
"Oh, we're just getting started."
We climbed the pyramid fast. Habanero, Ghost Pepper, Carolina Reaper. Each level was hotter than the last. But Donovan and I powered through. My face was sweating like crazy. And my throat felt like it had been scrubbed with sandpaper. But Donovan? The guy was in his element. He kept grabbing the samples without hesitation. Grinning like it was the best day of his life. When we hit Pepper X, the burn felt like someone had taken a blowtorch to my mouth. I gasped, blinking tears out of my eyes, and clutched my knees as the heat punched through my sinuses. "Holy crap," I wheezed. "This stuff hurts." Donovan, of course, wasn't satisfied.
"One more level,"
he said, wiping the sweat from his forehead with his sleeve. "Dude, we've already hit Pepper X," I said. "Nothing's supposed to be hotter than this."
"Wanna bet?"
Donovan grinned and pointed to the cart.
"Look at these other ones."
The vendor leaned in with that same eerie grin.
"He's right, you know. You've still got a ways to go if you want to hit the top."
I tried to talk Donovan out of it. Something about this felt wrong. But Donovan wouldn't listen. He was already grabbing the next snack from the cart. This one had no label. It was jet black, like someone had rolled charcoal dust onto it.
"Last one,"
Donovan said, popping it into his mouth. The change was instant. Donovan froze for a second, blinking hard. Then smoke, actual smoke, began curling out of his nostrils. At first, I thought it was some kind of trick or prank. Maybe the vendor had put dry ice in the snack to mess with us. But then I smelled it. Burning hair and scorched skin. "Donovan?" I whispered. He exhaled slowly, black ash puffing from his mouth. His eyes were wide, but he looked calm. Too calm. Like he was under some kind of spell. "Dude, you okay?" I grabbed his arm, but he didn't respond. He just smiled dreamily and reached for another snack. The vendor stood silently, watching with that same damn grin, like this was a show he'd seen 100 times before.
"Stop him!" I shouted at the vendor. "He's burning! Do something!"
The vendor shrugged.
"He's climbing the pyramid! Can't stop him now!"
Donovan's skin started blistering. Red whelps popped up on his arms and face, then burst open with little hisses of steam. He didn't even flinch. His hair, still damp with sweat, dried instantly and caught fire. I grabbed for the snack in his hand, desperate to stop him. But the moment my fingers touched it, pain shot through me like I'd stuck my hand into molten lava. I screamed and yanked my hand away, watching in horror as blisters formed and popped along my palm. Donovan, stop! I begged, but he didn't even hear me. He shoved another chip into his mouth, his grin widening as his skin peeled away like paper. His teeth showed through cracked lips, and his fingernails fell off, but he kept eating. Then the worst part, his eyes started to boil. At first, they just looked cloudy, like he had cataracts. But then they swelled and hissed, little bubbles forming along the whites. Pop. His left eye exploded in a burst of steam. Pop. The right one followed. And still, he kept eating. I couldn't take it anymore. I turned and ran, screaming for help. My vision blurred with tears and sweat as I sprinted down the block, shouting for anyone who would listen. A couple of people stopped and stared in confusion, but no one moved to help. By the time I dragged a group of adults back to the spot, the cart was gone. No vendor, no snacks, no sign of Donovan. Just a greasy, blackened stain on the pavement where he'd stood.
"Where's your friend?"
one of the adults asked. I pointed to the charred outline. He was right there. They all looked at me like I was crazy. The police didn't believe me. They said maybe Donovan had gotten mixed up in some dumb prank, or that I was in shock from witnessing something traumatic. They tried to tell me it was a hallucination or some freak incident. Maybe spice poisoning. But Donovan's parents? They weren't buying it. They blamed me from day one. Told everyone that I'd gotten their perfect son into trouble and run with the wrong crowd. They made it clear they thought I was covering up something worse, maybe even responsible for his disappearance. Every time I saw them, they looked at me with pure hatred. They moved away a few months later. I think it was easier for them to start over somewhere else. Away from the town where Donovan vanished. The cops marked it as a cold case, a likely abduction. Maybe a runaway situation. Though they never found any leads. No body, no evidence, nothing. But I know what I saw. I don't touch spicy food anymore. I can't even walk down that street without feeling sick. And when the wind blows just right, I swear I can still smell ash in the air. Like a faint reminder of what happened. So here's my advice. If you ever see a cart offering free spicy snacks, just walk away. Don't even look at it. Trust me, you'll thank me later.
That was The Heat Pyramid by Craig Groeschek, as performed by Christopher Drape, featuring Kevin Barbary. And if there's one thing we've learned tonight, it's that there are some fires that never die out. You can quench your thirst, cool your mouth, even douse your body in ice. But once the right flame takes hold, it keeps burning. That was Christopher's debut narration with us. We know he'd appreciate it if you dropped a comment and let him know what you think. Thanks for your support. Now, Craig Groeschek, the author of that last story, as many of you may know, is the founder of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, curating and crafting horror for audiences worldwide. And if you want more of his work, be sure to visit creepypastastories.com, where his nightmares and hundreds of others await. But for now, we leave the fire behind and step into something far colder. And trust me, the cold is much, much worse. Our next tale takes us from searing flames to a world of ice and isolation. We journey now to the remote Alaskan wilderness, where something ancient and hungry lurks just beyond the firelight. Something that stalks in the snowdrifts, hiding in the howling wind. The locals say you'll hear it first, the deep pounding of unseen drums growing louder with every gust. When the storm rolls in, that is when it's already too late. Written by Shane H. Sellers and performed by Nick Goroff, this is The Beast of Port Smith.
Part 1. I stand alone, my breath forming frosty clouds as I gaze out into the desolate Alaskan winter through the window pane. The world beyond is a study in monochrome. A frozen wasteland that stretches to the ends of my vision. It's a sight both haunting and mesmerizing. The snow blankets the landscape, a pristine canvas untouched by human presence. Each flake is a tiny work of art, delicately arranged to create an undulating sea of white. The trees, with their branches heavy with hoarfrost, stand like sentinels in this realm. They seem frozen in time, their dark forms etched against the pale backdrop of the snow. The silence is profound, broken only by the occasional gust of wind that rattles the glass of my living room window. It's as if the world outside has been muffled by the snow, absorbing sound and leaving behind a profound hush. The stillness is both eerie and beautiful. Despite the bitter cold, there's a strange sense of peace in the desolation. It's a reminder of the raw power of nature, a place where the elements reign supreme and human existence seems insignificant in comparison. As I continue to peer out into the Alaskan winter, I can't help but feel a sense of awe and reverence for all the wild beauty of this unforgiving land. It all began on a frigid October morning in 1982.
Sheriff, I think you need to come down to the fishing stream next to the Baker's homestead. We got a body.
Deputy O'Connor's voice squeaked on the radio. Winter was hitting early this year. I expected a call about a stranded motorist or a welfare check. I didn't expect a body. Port Smith usually cleared out about this time. Most tourists and retirees went home before getting stuck here until spring. That usually translated into 5 months of boredom. I took another look at the desolate wilderness outside before keying the radio receiver. Roger, O'Connor. I'm on my way. Slipping on my parka, I looked from the window to the coffee table. Half a bottle of Old Forster sat gleaming in the lamplight. I pulled the Stetson from the wall hanger, propped it on my head, and walked over to the bottle, uncapping it. If there were ever a reason to drink, now would be the best time. But more and more, I was finding reasons. Hell, sometimes I didn't even need those. I put the bottle to my lips and drank, breathing in the oak-infused vanilla aroma. With the warm bourbon in my stomach, I picked up my keys and headed for the door. Emily Turner was a young woman in her 20s, lay sprawled across the snow-covered ground near a frozen fishing stream. An eerie contrast to the pristine whiteness surrounding her. Her once vibrant red hair was now matted and crystallized with frozen blood. Vacant green eyes stared into the gray sky above. Both her hands had been chewed off at the wrist, an indication she had tried shielding herself from an attack. What was especially peculiar about this scene was Emily's lack of clothing. She was naked as the day she was born. Perhaps she had decided to take a polar plunge in the frozen stream before being attacked. It's not uncommon for people to take cold dips, but usually they follow it up with a warm escape, like a sauna or a warm running car. They most certainly don't trek out this far to do it. Judging from the wounds, it could be a bear attack. Though most bears are hibernating around this time, it was possible one remained active. Deputy Alaku, an Inuit expert tracker, walked this scene with an eagle eye for details. His wind-chapped, brown face looked up at me with a perplexed look. "No tracks, Sheriff. Can't find anything except Tom's size 10 Thoroughgoods." "You think she entered the stream from another point? Floated under the ice and somehow emerged here?" I said, pondering the idea out loud. "Not a bad theory, Sheriff. Could explain why there's no blood trail." Deputy O'Connor walked up, his nose and cheeks flushed from the cold. "Tom Baker saw the body early this morning when he came out to feed the sled dogs. Said he usually walks back this way to take a gander at the stream. Thought it was a dead elk, but then he saw the red hair." "Did he see or hear anything out of the ordinary?" I asked. Deputy O'Connor leaned back, looking at the body. "Said he heard some sort of singing and drums last night around 8. Figured it was the wind carrying music or something from the town." "How far is town from here?" I asked. Deputy lifted his chin before responding. "Say, 10 miles, give or take." "That's awful far for music to travel." "Could have been a vehicle. The teens like to play their music loud when driving about." I nodded before looking back at Alaku. "Get Tom's statement and ask if he can spare some coffee." We spent most of the day taking photos of the scene and removing the body. Emily wasn't a local, but she had been in Portsmouth for 2 winters doing outreach work with the Inuit. By all accounts, Emily had integrated well, which made the job of storing her body in the town's equipment garage difficult. Although the freezing temperatures would preserve her body better than any morgue, it remained a challenge. Once back in town, I attempted to contact the mainland, but both the telephone and radio were down. This wasn't uncommon during the winter months. Atmospheric changes and extreme temperatures could drastically reduce the effectiveness of our long-range radios. The telephone lines could go out with the first ice storm. Honestly, I didn't think much of it at the time. Aside from the occasional drunken bar brawl, Portsmouth stayed quiet. Once comms were up, I called a medical examiner to be flown down from Anchorage. Until then, the best we could do was document the scene. The rest of the day was quiet. I filed the remaining paperwork, booked evidence, and had lunch at Stacy Diner. Like many other businesses, she would be closed at the end of the week. It didn't pay to stay open all winter. So most folks would batten down the hatches and open back up in May. Things around here were about to get quiet. Dead quiet. That afternoon, I headed home as the sun dipped below the horizon. Daylight was quickly becoming a scarcity as winter set in. The heater of the Bronco pumped warm air into the cab as I pushed the gruesome scene from my mind. It was best to leave such thoughts alone. To dwell was akin to inviting a ghost into your bed. There was work, and there was life. Separating the two was an art form. A knowledge that had cost me 2 marriages and a thirst for bourbon. My stomach grumbled. A nice hot shower and a can of Campbell's beef stew had hit the spot. I'd spend the night in a drunken haze, lulled to sleep by recorded reruns of Happy Days. It wasn't much, but life needed the lubrication of a good drink. How else would someone put up with the nonsense of this world? I pulled up to my driveway, the lights of the Bronco illuminating the snow-covered porch. In the past, I would have stopped to shovel a clear path, but the day had been long, and the promise of warmth beckoned me inside. I parked the car, turned off the engine, and stepped out into the clear night. I traversed the snowy path to my porch when a faint rhythm echoed in the distance. I paused, tilting my head toward the road. Deep vibrations rumbled in a series of quick droning beats. It sounded like drums. Ba-dump, 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 ba-dump. Was this the noise Tom Baker had heard the night before Emily was killed? The sound was lost in the wind before I could consider the thought anymore. I stood still, straining my ears, but nothing followed. The sound had come so quickly I questioned if I had even heard it. With one final glance at the starry sky above, I went inside. The next morning, I was awakened by a knock at the door. Pushing through the hangover, I stumbled from my recliner and found Deputy Laku waiting on my front porch. My head twisted in on itself as sunlight flooded my living room. A quick glance at my watch showed 6:20.
What?
What do you need, Laku? I said, shielding my eyes. Sorry to wake you, Sheriff. I didn't want the news to get out on the radio, but we've got another body.
Another body? Damn, who is it?
Not sure yet. It's messy. Also looks like we've got a cold front incoming. We'll be getting severe weather later tonight. Temp's going to bottom out. Might be a blizzard. Any luck in reaching Anchorage? Nope. Long-range radio and phones are still out.
Damn it.
Give me 10 minutes to get ready.
Did you bring coffee?
I said, rubbing the stubble on my chin. No, Sheriff. Came straight here once the body was found.
Yeah, make that 15 minutes then. We'll take you a ride.
Part 2. Nicholas Hudson discovered the second victim, Ralph Jensen, when venturing out to a public cabin to hunt for doll sheep. Poor man crapped himself and spent the next 15 minutes sitting in it as he drove back to the police station. It took an hour and a set of fresh boxers before he agreed to take a locker to the body. No amount of coaxing could get him to go back inside the cabin. After seeing the body, I could understand why. Like Emily, Ralph had been naked. His body was eviscerated. His head was torn off and placed on a wicker chair that faced the front door. The log walls of the cabin were frozen with his blood, and his eyes were missing. This was calculated brutality, something no animal would do, which led to a more disturbing conclusion. If this wasn't an animal, then we had a killer on the loose. The very idea sickened me. Ralph was a widowed retiree who owned an art studio in Anchorage. He must have been using the cabin to warm himself while photographing the wilderness. A theory backed up by a satchel of camera equipment in the corner of the room and a frozen cup of cocoa on the stove. His Ford truck was parked at the bottom of the trail, making his hike a little more than a mile up to the cabin. From the looks of things, he must have been here at least a day. Long enough for the wood stove to go cold, which would place the murderer around the same time Emily was found. The metallic smell of blood and feces prompted me to retreat outside in pursuit of fresh air. Between yesterday and this morning, I was riding on coffee and nursing a hangover, a recipe that caused me to lean against the front porch railing for balance. I needed to stay strong for now, or at least keep the appearance up. What was going on? This was Port Smith, not New York. We didn't get psycho killers. People knew each other here. They hunkered down to survive the harsh winters together. They didn't go around tearing each other up like crazed butchers, and they most certainly didn't take their neighbors' eyes for souvenirs. Deputy O'Connor stood next to Nicholas, who sat on the stump collecting himself.
Jesus, I just wanted to do some hunting. I didn't expect all this. Y'all promise not to tell anybody about me messing myself, right?
Nicholas asked. Deputy O'Connor bent down, putting his hand on Nicholas's shoulder.
Take it easy, Nick. I just need to get a statement from you and I'll drive you back into town. You did good today. There's no shame in it.
The moment was interrupted as Deputy Alaku passed by the two. Found something you might want to see, Sheriff. I descended the cabin's front steps, following Alaku through the tree line to an opening where the river flowed. Alaku crouched low next to the stream, gesturing toward a series of frozen prints. Ralph came down here to get water sometime before nightfall, which makes me believe he spent most of yesterday afternoon in the cabin. The prints over there are where he filled his bucket. So that gives us an estimated time of death, I replied. Deputy Alaku stood and walked to an outcrop of dead branches. At first I thought he had slipped when he dipped his bucket in the water, but the prints are too heavy and unbalanced for that. Plus, I found this. Deputy Alaku reached behind the pile of broken limbs, retrieving a small, galvanized bucket. Something scared Ralph, made him throw the bucket this way, chased him all the way back to the cabin before butchering him. Any tracks belonging to our culprit? I asked, stuffing my hands for warmth into my pockets. All sorts of tracks up here, Sheriff, but nothing recent and nothing man-made. What about a bear? Bears don't arrange furniture and body parts. Alaku's words cemented my suspicion we were dealing with a killer. I couldn't tell what first made me shiver, the plummeting temperature or realizing that fact. How does someone tear a man's head off his shoulders? Maybe an electric winch? Could have anchored him against a tree using ropes, then attached the winch cable around his neck and... pop, Alaku said, mimicking a pulling motion with his hands. God damn, I replied, lowering my gaze in disgust. We bagged Ralph's body and taped off the scene of the cabin. I had Deputy O'Connor take a man-pack radio to the snowcat to see if he could get a signal atop the valley. I hated to lose a deputy, but O'Connor knew the cat better than anyone else. The trip would take him a full day of travel, but if we were lucky, he could bounce his signal off one of the repeaters. Despite my efforts to keep a lid on the murders, news of the killings quickly reached the town. A mob of 20 or so citizens gathered outside the station. Alaku and I pushed past the small crowd, making our way to the patrol Bronco when we were stopped by Hubert McCuskey, the town mayor.
Sheriff, we have a big problem, and these citizens have a right to know what's happening, Hubert said, already posturing with authority.
Sensing the panic, I lifted my hands in the air, trying to calm the crowd.
Quiet! Quiet, damn it! Since yesterday, we have had two bodies. We suspect there may be foul play involved. Sheriff, you're out of your league here. We need mainland authorities.
I raised my hand again, Hubert's words adding to the mounting pressure behind my eyes. I've attempted to contact the mainland, but we're in a communication blackout. I've dispatched Deputy O'Connor with the snowcat and a portable radio. He should be back by tomorrow. Until then, I'm issuing a curfew for all residents. The crowd began to protest, but I was quick to put a stop to it. The town is closed until further notice. Go home, people. Don't come out until noon tomorrow. By then, Deputy O'Connor should be back with word. Until then, anyone caught on the streets will be considered a suspect.
You can't do that, Sheriff, Hubert interjected.
I got two bodies that say otherwise, Hubert. So unless you want to spend the night in a cold jail cell, I suggest you start helping me disperse the crowd. George Flattery, a towering man with a weathered face, stepped between me and Hubert. He was accompanied by Joe Yusek Stillwater, an Inuit tracker. What can we do to help, Sheriff? I looked to Ulaku and then back to George Nusak. I'm deputizing both of you. Each of you raise your right hand.
This is insane, Hubert scoffed. Wait. Hey, count me in too, Sheriff,
the young man said, pushing through the crowd.
My name's Mike Wallach. I just came here this past summer after graduating from Fairbanks.
The Sheriff needs men, not boys, Hubert barked.
I'm a hard worker, Sheriff,
Wallach said.
Done fishing and crabbing most of my life. I know my place, and I'll do what's asked of me.
This is madness, Sheriff. Just you wait until the real authorities hear about this. We'll have your badge so fast,
the mayor screamed.
Can it, Hubert?
George said, pushing him aside. Do each of you swear to uphold the law as a downed deputy? I said. And to act with integrity, loyalty, and unwavering resolve in your duties as a volunteer deputy. George Flattery nodded, removing the Ushanka from his head.
I do, Sheriff.
Usak nodded in affirmation, while Mike followed.
Me too. I do.
With the power vested in me as Sheriff, I hereby deputize each of you until your services are no longer required.
Glad to be aboard, Sheriff. What do you need us to do now?
George said, putting his cap back on.
You got a rifle?
Got a Winchester Model 70 in my truck.
Go get it. But I want the rest of you unarmed for now. Ain't no sense in causing a panic. Start directing these folks back home.
George nodded and looked to Mike and Usak, who began to disperse the crowd. This seemed to take some of the steam out of Hubert, but I knew he had only retreated for the moment. Men like him were the calculating type, always looking for the best opportunity to seize on a crisis. I'll deal with Hubert another time. For now, I had bigger fish to fry. Ulaku and I would drive back to the hunting cabin where Ralph Jensen was found. I needed to take one more look at the scene to make sure I wasn't missing something. Part 3. The sun dipped below the valley as the Ford Bronco rumbled along the snow-covered trail, casting a blue hue across the frozen snowdrifts. Beside me, Ulaku sat, his eyes scanning the surroundings with practiced vigilance. The silence inside was profound, broken only by the occasional howl of the wind as it beat against the glass of the Bronco. It was as if the world outside had been muffled by the snow, absorbing sound and leaving behind a profound hush, an eerie quiet that seemed to amplify the weight of our thoughts.
These killings, they're savage, sadistic. I've never seen anything like it. Have you?
Ulaku nodded, his voice low and steady.
In Vietnam, we had the Rat King.
Rat who? I asked.
Staff Sergeant Green. The CIA sent him to help us find Charlie in the Mekong Delta. I was 9 months into a tour of duty. Up until then, it was your standard search and destroy missions. They would hit us and melt away into the surrounding hamlets. Then they sent the Rat King in.
What does this have to do with the murders?
Staff Sergeant Green was a killer. In society, you'd lock him up and throw away the key. Hell, it would probably be better if you shot him. But in the war, he fit right in. He used to keep a rat on his shoulder like a pirate. But in truth, the rats followed him everywhere. I mean big, giant rats. Some the size of dogs. Never seen anything like it. The guy was a walking disease. But he had a way of tracking the enemy. In 3 weeks, we killed at least 20 Viet Cong and avoided an ambush that would have decimated the first platoon. One day, the Rat King tracked an NVA recon element to a village. Our company had been there probably 100 times before, knew all the mama and papa-sons by name. I didn't get there until later with 2nd Platoon. By that time, it was all too late. The Rat King had butchered everyone in the village. I'd never seen anything like it. Men and women skinned alive. Children and babies boiled in rice pots. And the rats feasting on it all. He watched about brutality. After that, I lost faith in humanity for a long time. Didn't start feeling right until I came back here. Did they court-martial this sick freak? I asked, unsettled by the story. Palaku laughed. No, they promoted him and sent him to Cambodia. Jesus Christ. Malaku's story stuck to me like dirt on sweaty white socks. It was the horrifying face of the real world. A truth that many hid from or outright ignored. It was nature itself. The primordial need for conquest and brutality its fuel. My chest hurt. Indigestion boiling up in my abdomen. I needed to make this right. Restore the facade. Go back to hiding. Go back to ignoring the reality. Is that why we're making another trip to the cabin in the dark? Alaku spoke up, breaking the silence between us. It's something you said earlier today, about Ralph being in the cabin for most of the afternoon and being attacked at nightfall. I heard music last night. The same music that Tom mentioned hearing the night Emily was murdered. What are you getting at, Sheriff? I'm not sure. I think the killer might stay in the area after the killing. I can't explain the noise yet. Somehow, it all connected. Alaku's gaze met mine, his eyes reflecting an unspoken perseverance. We'll get to the bottom of this, Sheriff, no matter what it takes. We won't let fear paralyze us. His words were a reassurance, a glimmer of hope in the face of an unfathomable darkness. With a deep breath, I gripped the steering wheel tighter, a sense of renewed determination filling my veins as I navigated the Bronco through an outcrop of Sitka spruce. When we arrived at the cabin, Alaku stepped out, arming himself with a Remington 12-gauge shotgun. We approached the icy steps, flooding the cabin's interior with our flashlights. Ralph Jensen's crystallized blood sparkled in the light as our breaths lingered in the frigid air. The cabin had been a morbid place during the day, but it transformed into a place of pure wickedness in the dark. A heavy feeling of terror paired with the frozen wilderness that surrounded us. Our lights crisscrossed the exposed wooden beams of the cabin, coming to a stop on an effigy dangled precariously from a rafter. The ghoulish decoration was made of small animal bones held together with sinew and Emily's red hair. I didn't see this today, I said, approaching it. It wasn't here when we left, Sheriff. A sense of dread washed over me as I turned to Alaku and met his gaze. The bastard came back. Suddenly, my radio came to life with Mike's voice on the other end.
Sheriff, are you there?
In the background, George's voice came. Stop playing with that, kid. Give me the radio. Sheriff, it's George Flattery. You'd better come to town. I think we found Mayor McCluskey. Or what's left of him. My face brimmed with anger. Hubert was a pain in the ass, but he didn't deserve this. Nor did Emily or Ralph. I unstrapped the radio on my belt, bringing it up to speak. George, this might sound weird, but did you or the others hear anything before you found Hubert? There was a long pause before the radio hissed.
Usak said he heard drums.
Good, listen. I want you and the others to secure the area. Don't touch anything until we get back.
Roger, Sheriff.
I looked back to Ulaku as he stood in the shadows, running his hand over a window seal in the back part of the cabin. He retrieved something and held it up to his flashlight.
What is it?
Looks like a blend of human and dog hair, Ulaku replied, shifting the hair towards me. Indeed, the bundle of hair resembled that of a dog, only tangled with what appeared to be strands of brown pubic hair. Like the effigy, this evidence wasn't here this morning, meaning the killer must have returned to this site just as we had left. Then, a more unsettling thought occurred to me. Had the killer never left the scene? Only remaining concealed within in the forest as he or she watched us do our investigation?
Baghdad, we need to get back to town. The boys found Hubert's body, I said, looking at the fibers Ulaku held within his gloved hand.
Sheriff, something doesn't add up. We didn't pass anyone on the way up here, and the logging roads are now impassable. How did someone return to do this and still have time to make it back to town to murder Hubert? Digging my hands into my pockets for warmth, I thought momentarily before responding. It's possible they used a dog sled. There are numerous trails all over this forest for sledding and snowmobiles. It might also explain the hair. That would make Tom Baker a likely suspect. He has sled dogs and was the one that reported Mrs. Turner, Ulaku said as he retrieved an evidence bag from his coat pocket.
Could be, but I never pegged Tom as a homicidal butcher. Let's lock up and get out of here before we freeze. We can follow up on that lead once we get to town.
Ulaku carefully inserted the hairs into the evidence bag as we exited the cabin. My hunch was right, but while I was playing catch-up, the killer had been able to strike again. My hands started to shake as I opened the door. The steady diet of caffeine and bourbon was starting to catch up to me, but I couldn't stop now. We were so close to solving the case, I just needed to dig a little deeper. Keep myself focused on what was important. Ulaku came from behind, taking the keys from my shaking hands.
I'll drive back. You need rest.
I wanted to protest, but my body responded by pulling away from the driver's door. I had to be smart about this. I needed a clear head, and if letting Ulaku drive back gave me a few moments of rest, I would do it. This was a marathon, not a sprint. I had no idea how much longer the killings would continue. Hopefully, Deputy O'Connor would be back the next day with good news. Until then, I had no other choice but to continue. I sat down in the passenger seat as Ulaku started the Bronco's engine. I could already feel my hands starting to steady. There's elk jerky in the glove box and water in my canteen. You need to eat something. I shifted in my seat, opened the glove box, and retrieved a Ziploc bag of elk jerky. The sweet aroma of seasoned meat wafted through the cab. My mouth watered as I took the first few bites. How had I neglected myself this much? I was supposed to be the sheriff, the person responsible for Port Smith's safety. Yet, I couldn't even take care of myself. A twinge of shame came with that reflection. It was something that made me want to crawl back into the bottle. Alaku's face met mine in the glow of the cab. Something was gnawing at him, an unsettling feeling that we both shared. Then, softly, he spoke. My grandmother told me horrible stories when I was a young boy. Stories about dogs that slept with witches, tribes that ate the flesh of men. She said they always come with a storm and announce themselves with music and gifts of flesh. To most, it's an omen, but for some, it's an offer to run with the pack. She called them the Adlets. Sounds like your grandmother was a few cans short of a six-pack. Blaku smiled and nodded. She was crazy, but I can't help but think about her stories now. I took a long swig from the canteen as Blaku steered the Bronco back down the road. We were out of the forest, back on the hard-packed road just as the snow started. The weather would only get worse in the next few hours. We needed to move fast before the brunt of the storm hit. Part 4. By the time we reached the outskirts of town, the wind had picked up, blowing the fresh snow across the empty streets. Mike Wallach ran to the driver's side door as Alaku cracked the window enough for him to peer inside.
"George found him first," Mike said, pulling down his scarf.
"Take me to the body," I replied, unbuckling my seatbelt. Outside, the wind nipped at my face as I followed Mike down the street past Al Jordan's pharmacy. George and Usak stood huddled at the end with flashlights in hand. On the ground, a blue tarp anchored by cement blocks concealed Hubert's mangled body. Dark puddles of frozen blood and viscera blotted the pristine whiteness of the snow.
"Sorry about the tarp, Sheriff. Hubert was an asshole, but it just seemed like the decent thing to do," George said.
I pushed past him, stooping down to pull back the tarp. Hubert's face was smashed flat. The back of his skull shattered outwards like a broken plate. Large globs of what looked like strawberry jam lay frozen on the pavement. It all looked unreal. Like one of those cartoons where the coyote gets flattened by a huge rock. But this was a person I had known for 8 years.
"I saw a Chinese man's head like that at Chong'an River. Second Infantry dropped 105s on them. Didn't need to hit him. Concussion made their brains leak out of their ears and noses," George said, pointing a light at the substance. Hubert was still dressed in his tan parka and insulated pants, causing me to stand to my feet and scan the area.
"When you found him, was the blood still warm?"
"Yeah, there was steam coming off the body. Adusak and the kids searched the block, but they didn't spot anything. We've been here ever since." Usak came alongside George, his face barely visible on account of the oversized fur hoodie he wore.
"I heard drums before we found Hubert. Reminded me of the Quillut that the Angaquit used during their ceremonies."
"What's an Angaquit?" Mike interrupted.
"It's what the white man calls a shaman," Usak replied dismissively.
I pulled the tarp back over Hubert's body before facing the three. "When we found Emily and Ralph, the killer had stripped them naked. I think he's doing some type of ritual with the bodies. Ralph had his eyes removed."
"Jesus!"
Mike blurted out. "I'd wager a bottle of Evan Williams that the killer is still here."
"What do you want us to do, Sheriff?"
George said, unshouldering his rifle.
"I want you three to take your truck and park it down by the church. Keep to the shadows and come up behind the pharmacy. Al keeps a spare key under the mat by the back door. Let yourselves in and use the front window to keep watch. Alaku and I will drive up to the water plant that overlooks the town. It's a good vantage point with a view of the streetlights. Anyone comes near that body, you apprehend them."
George nodded before turning with the others towards his truck. The night was growing colder, and the full force of the storm would be on us soon. This plan had to work. I wasn't sure how much more of this I could stomach. I could already feel the tremors in my hands coming back. God, I needed a drink. I just needed to hold it together for a little longer. I climbed back into the Bronco, removing my gloves and warming my hands on the vent.
Where to, Sheriff? Alaku asked.
We're setting an ambush using Hubert's body. Let's drive to the water plant and keep an eye out there.
Roger that, Sheriff, Laku said, shifting the Bronco out of park. We turned on Main Street, driving past the equipment garage and uphill toward the water plant, all the while scanning the dark alleys and nooks of the town for signs of movement. A part of me wished it could be so simple. A car or a person hiding in the ditch. But this killer was elusive, and they knew what they were doing. There would be nothing easy about tonight. But there was a chance the killer was still hiding in town. If that were the case, they would have to move soon or freeze. My thoughts were interrupted as Alaku brought the vehicle to a stop at the water plant. I unscrewed the canteen cap and took another sip just as Alaku cut the engine. The plant was a metal building, just big enough to house several pumps that cycled water from the basin to the town. The inside was dark, lit only by the glow of incandescent lamps attached to exposed piping. Alaku and I crouched in the shadows, the eerie silence broken only by the mechanical hum of a generator and the whooshing sounds of water being pulled through the pumps. An hour passed as the darkness seemed to thicken around us. Keeping watch from a small window, I saw the blue tarp covering Hubert's body flapping in the dim streetlights below. This plan was starting to feel like a waste of time. My feet throbbed as the cold radiated through my boots. I was starting to shake uncontrollably. My hands went deeper into my parka, fingers already numb from the exposure. We would have to go back to the Bronco soon. The pump station was just warm enough to keep the pipes from freezing. If we stayed much longer, we would risk being trapped in the storm.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Then, just as I was about to unholster my radio, a faint sound pierced the silence. A chilling, guttural growl, accompanied by a drum's slow, rhythmic beat. The sound was close this time, rattling the glass window pane with every beat. Usagg was right in his description. The drum was something the Inuit used during their ceremonies. I only knew this because I had seen it at public festivals held for tourists. This was different, though. It was loud. Louder than I'd ever heard. Almost like the sound was being energized by some unforeseen force. The wind carried the music across the countryside. A warning that something evil was being conjured. Alaku and I exchanged a glance, our eyes filled with bewilderment. Without speaking, we both knew to act swiftly. We crept out of our hiding place, traversing the darkness like phantoms, guided by the eerie drumbeat that grew louder with each step. We exited the pump station into the blizzard's fury, our path lit only by service light that hung from the bay door of the facility. The source of the sinister sounds was a dilapidated sawmill at the edge of town. Faint candlelight seeped through the gaps of the weathered wood, acting as a beacon. The path was deep in freshly fallen snow. Each step plunged us waist-deep into the cold, frozen ground. I struggled to catch my breath as Alaku cut the path before me. My heart pounded, and my legs were heavy from the exertion, yet I moved forward through the icy gaps. The snow was starting to soak through, stinging my exposed flesh. Wet clothing was deadly, but my options were few, and the sawmill was only a few more yards away. Smoke bellowed from a rusted flue pipe on the side of the mill. Sweet God, there was fire inside. On the verge of exhaustion, we reached the mill with weapons drawn. I tried to muffle my breathing, hoping not to reveal our approach. Alaku pulled the sliding door open just enough for us to squeeze inside. The drum beat heavily, vibrating the mill's walls and sending dust particles floating through the air. This kept us hidden as we navigated the candlelit interior, coming to two large wood stoves in the center. My fingers and toes throbbed as they thawed, a good indicator I would keep all my digits. But now I was starting to get lightheaded, the last of my energy sapped by the journey here. The .357 Magnum felt almost unwieldy in my hand. I would have to count on Alaku's shotgun for my lack of accuracy if it came down to a gun battle. Ahead of us, a partially concealed figure stood in silhouette by the candlelight. Its focus seemed to be on a makeshift altar comprised of bones and antlers that ascended the entire wall. Ralph Jensen's eyes glisten inside the skull of an elk, a handful of Emily's red hair curled around the antlers. In the flicker of candlelight, I could make out the beast's form. It was tall, much taller than any human, with a hulking muscular frame that bristled with matted fur. A dark brown mane wrapped around its neck and extended down its back into a bushy tail. Its face was surprisingly human but distorted, with an elongated muzzle and a set of sharp canines. Two fiery orbs of yellowish-green eyes glinted with a feral intelligence and an insatiable hunger. The beast struck the drum with its palm, careful not to puncture it with its extended claws. Each rap was amplified by something unseen. I couldn't explain how it was done. Even a concealed microphone wouldn't be capable of such volume. The instrument of stretched skin bore a faded tattoo, a shocking realization that it was not made from any animal hide. At last, we had found the killer musician. But my mind wrestled with the logic of it all. I knew what I was looking at, but dear God, what was it? The creature lowered the drum, allowing it to dangle from its body on a lanyard of colored beads. Its ears pricked up, and hot breath sprayed into the air as it snorted. The beast was catching our scent. We had to act fast while the element of surprise was still on our side. Alaku and I burst forth, opening fire from our concealed corner of the room. The .357 kicked hard in my hand, the shot going wide and missing by several inches. Alaku was more successful as pellets from the shotgun dug deep into the fur chest of the beast. For a moment, it seemed like we might have the upper hand as the beast reeled back against the altar. But then it darted through us, tossing us aside like rag dolls and crashing through the wall to make its escape. For a few seconds, I lay sprawled out on the sawdust-covered floor, my vision going in and out, the impact leaving me dizzy. I lifted my head, looking at the broken wall through which the wind and snow poured in. Alaku's eyes met mine as bright arterial blood jetted from his neck. He opened his mouth to say something, but only a gargling sound escaped. Without thinking, I rushed to his side, desperately attempting to staunch the bleeding with my gloved hand. The wound was deep, severing the carotid artery. Giant, red, foaming bubbles formed with each labored breath. I held Alaku in my arms as his face went pale. His eyes darted around the room and then back to me before fading. Everything went quiet, except the sound of the howling wind from outside. A sense of loss washed over me as I looked down at my friend's lifeless body. This wasn't supposed to happen. We were smart about our approach. We had the drop. Anger swelled up inside me like scalding water. I picked myself up with gritted teeth and went to where the beast had escaped. A deep indentation, speckled with blood, descended the slope towards town. It was wounded and trying to find someplace warm. It was falling into my trap, and this time I would kill the thing. Grabbing my radio, I called Mike and the others. Mike, this is the sheriff. I want you and the others to go quietly to the station. Keep your lights off and don't investigate anything. I'm on my way there now. The static on the radio hissed for a second, and Mike's voice returned.
Roger, Sheriff. We'll see you in Alaku soon.
I paused at the mention of Alaku before keying the radio. Alaku's not coming. He's gone. Part 5. As I stepped through the heavy wooden door of the station, a rush of warm air engulfed me, instantly bringing relief from the frigid air outside. The scent of old wood and musty carpeting permeated the air, mingling with the faint aroma of coffee that lingered from the last pot brewed. George, Usak, and Mike sat attentively in the main lobby. The station was quiet, save for the soft hum of a flickering fluorescent light overhead. A dull, low murmur from the storm outside occasionally punctuated the silence, a reminder of the impending blizzard. Usak stood first, his brown eyes seeing the blood on my parka. You okay, Sheriff? We're not dealing with a human. It's something else. Some sort of beast, I said bluntly, rubbing my hands together.
What do you mean?
Mike said, taking off his trapper hat. He'd had pieces of Emily and Ralph up there in the sawmill. He was doing some kind of ritual. Usak went rigid. My people call it the adult. It's an abomination.
What are you going on about? George protested.
I know how it sounds. Believe me. I would think I was crazy too if the roles were reversed. I gestured down to the blood-soaked uniform and then back to George. Alaku got it with the Remington. It's wounded and hiding in the town now. It can't survive out there with the storm. That means we have a chance to kill it. George stared blankly back at me and then looked at Usak.
What about Alaku?
Mike asked. The thing got him in the throat. He's dead.
Are you sure? I mean, did you...
Listen, kid. He bled out before I could do anything. There's nothing to be done but get even. Usak, do you have any idea how to stop this... adlet? I asked. Usak took a moment, his brow furrowing. In some legends, our hunters used fire and spear. I reached into my pocket, pulled out my key ring and fumbled through the various keys until I found the silver one marked Armory. Looking back to the trio, I motioned for them to follow me. Back 4 years ago, Russian ships were spotted 50 miles off Port Hope. Got the army so scared of a Soviet invasion they shipped a crate of these from Fort Wainwright. I unlocked a gray gun cabinet, pulled out 4 oiled M16 A1 rifles and set them down on the armorer's bench. I then reached down and opened a large ammo can and began dispersing aluminum 20-round magazines to the group.
Holy hell!
Mike said, grabbing one of the rifles in his hand. Careful you don't blow our balls off with that, George said, pushing the muzzle of Mike's rifle safely away. You know how to shoot one of these? I asked the group. George slapped the magazine into the rifle and pulled the handle back, chambering around. Mike nodded.
My dad was a Green Beret. We used to go to the range with him on Saturdays. It's nothing I can't figure out,
Usak said. One more thing, I said, pulling out a green crate with 12 cardboard cylinders. George grabbed one of the containers and started to unwrap it. For God's sake, Willie Pete? I haven't used this since Korea.
Willie who? Mike said.
White phosphorus, George replied, looking annoyed. I cleared my throat, looking at each of the men standing before me. Listen, this stuff burns hotter than the sun and can raise the whole town. No Rambo nonsense. We take the Bronco and some road flares and work our way down the streets. Hopefully we can flush it out. Once clear of the town, we use the grenades on it. The tension in the room grew palpable as each man accepted the gravity of our mission. There was no turning back now. Armed with rifles and white phosphorus grenades, we were our town's last line of defense against this monstrous adversary. As the men loaded the rest of the magazines, I went into the locker room to retrieve a spare uniform and cold weather jacket. I ran hot water from the sink, staring at my reflection in the fogged mirror. My face a patchwork of cracked, dried blood and filth. More telling than that was the bruised circles around my eyes and the gauntness in my cheeks. Bile retched up in the back of my throat as I puked. I braced myself against the porcelain, a series of dry heaves rippling through me. I stared back at the mirror before saying to myself, I'm going to kill this thing. Piling into the Bronco, the engine roared to life with a growl of power that seemed dwarfed by the task at hand. The streets of Port Smith were quiet, the storefronts standing like empty monuments against the inky night. Snow was now coming down so fast that the wipers struggled to keep up. If not for the street lamps marking the way, I would have crashed at least twice. We followed the town's grid, methodically passing each intersection. I stopped the Bronco as George, Mike, and Usak exited and began to walk alongside it. At every corner, one of the men would throw a flare, casting a flickering red glow against the storefronts. The tension was unbearable as we turned down 6th Avenue, headlights washing over Hildebrand's taxidermy store. Through the front window, a stuffed brown bear stood with arms outstretched. Instinctively, I hit the brakes, causing the vehicle to come to a screeching halt. George took a combat stance with his rifle, pointing it toward the stuffed bear and lowering the weapon. Usak walked next to George, lit flare in hand. The two seemed to share a brief conversation, turning away from the window and looking back towards me. George pulled down his scarf, mouthing something about nearly crapping himself. I had just started to wave at him when a large hairy shadow came from behind the bear. I hit the horn with all my might, prompting the two men to look back at the store to see the sharp teeth of the beast peering behind the window. Gunfire erupted from behind me as Mike opened up with his rifle. The burst was well placed, shattering through the glass and ripping the beast's ear off. George and Usak joined in, unloading their rifles into the building. A torrent of lead tore through the wood and brick, kicking up debris and exploding the stuffed bear into a shower of cotton and fur. The wooden taxidermy sign swung down, held in place by a single chain. The beast retreated, red mist spraying against the wall as several rounds impacted its right arm and chest. Another shot tore through its muzzle, causing it to stagger and fall to the floor. Seeing the beast go down, the men halted their fire.
"Did we get it?"
shouted Mike from behind the Bronco. I could barely hear George shout back a response over the wind outside. Mike knocked on my window, causing me to jump in my seat.
"I hope Mr. Hildebrand has good insurance,"
Mike said before disappearing behind the Bronco. Usak investigated the window as George cautiously walked behind him. I unfastened my seatbelt, ready to join the party when a round, heavy object soared across my hood. The object hit George square in the back with enough force to knock him to the ground. Bewildered, I looked into the rearview mirror to see a much larger beast standing next to Mike's headless body. A geyser of blood pulsated from the torn flesh of his neck, soaking his bright green vest. George screamed in terror as Mike's head came to rest next to him. Panic seized me as I came to the realization there were two killers. Usak, sensing something was wrong, turned from the window, raising his rifle. The beams of the Bronco's lights blinded him to the second creature's presence. He began to move toward George when the wounded beast sailed through the store window, landing on the street curb below. The creature snarled through broken teeth, bringing its claws down onto Usak's back. In an instant, the second, larger beast lifted the back of the Bronco, tipping the vehicle to its side. I fell into the passenger seat, the cab filling with an assortment of napkins and empty coffee cups that fluttered through the air like a confetti parade. My knee smashed into the cassette player, the voice of Hank Williams singing, "Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?" The music continued over the sound of busted glass and grinding metal. The engine sputtered, noxious fumes stinging my eyes. The wounded beast was now on top of Usak, stabbing its claws deeper into his back, removing handfuls of yellowish-white fat and swollen red muscle. The creature leaned back and began to snort through its mangled muzzle. It was laughing. The thing was laughing as it tore through Usak. The snorting got louder, blending with Hank Williams' singing, reaching a pitch until bullets ripped through the creature's chest, knocking it back. The report of George's M16 reverberated through the empty street. He was on his feet now, spraying the beast with well-aimed shots.
"You bastard!" George yelled.
George dropped the empty rifle, reached into his jacket pocket, and retrieved the grenade. He pulled the pin, releasing the safety lever and tossing it onto the beast. A powerful popping sound emitted, then a bright, blinding flash as white sparks exploded high into the sky. The wounded adlet was engulfed in fire. It thrashed in the snow, trying to smother the flames, but the white phosphorus continued to burn. The second adlet was now rushing forth from behind the overturned Bronco. The cries of its partner seemed to quicken its response. It reached with its long arms, attempting to pull the burning husk free, but the scorching flames made it recoil away. George had picked up his rifle and was trying to reload it when the beast's attention shifted back to him. Pain radiated through my back as I twisted free of the seat and kicked the front windshield. The cracked glass broke free, and I shimmied my way onto the ice-covered pavement. I reached inside the cab, hooking my fingers on the sling of the rifle and trying to pull it out. The rifle didn't budge. I cursed out loud, putting my head back into the window. The rifle was caught between the headrest and seatbelt. I shoved it forward, trying to jar it loose with no success. Behind me, heavy footsteps followed by a low growl. I rolled away from the wreckage, facing the spot where I had last seen the beast.
"George, get out of here!"
I yelled as the creature advanced. The beast was fast, its brownish fur blending into the night. George had inserted the fresh mag into his rifle and was about to charge the bolt when it grabbed him by one hand, lifting him off the ground Tendrils of hot drool spattered George's face as the beast brought him closer to its open maw. It extended one clawed finger, plunging it deep into his belly and then cut upwards. He screamed in agony, his bowels spewing forth in a hot, steaming pile of gore. George's mouth filled with blood. His eyes dashed wildly back and forth before finding me. With a flip of his hand, he threw his M16. The rifle hit the road, bounced once, and slid to a stop in front of me. I grabbed it just as the beast sunk its teeth into his neck with a resounding crunch. My chest throbbed, and my heart pounded. I went to stand, my left knee buckling under my weight. I reached out, stabilizing myself against the Bronco's roof, and then bounded to the alleyway. Cold air hit my face as the snow blew directly into my eyes. I tried to get a hold of my breathing, my left arm going numb, my legs heavy. But I kept putting one foot in front of the other. I was having a heart attack. I entered the alleyway, bracing myself against the walls. My chest felt as though it was about to explode. I had 3 blocks to go, and I was already struggling. I needed to get my heart rate down and buy some time. A set of backdoor steps beckoned me. It was dark there, and I could sit until the pain subsided. I turned, scanning the alleyway behind me before falling to the 3rd step. In my gloved hands, I gripped the rifle, feeling the frozen metal through the layers of my winter gear. Cold penetrated every layer of clothing, seeping into my bones. But the adrenaline coursing through my veins kept me alert. I flipped the safety selector to auto and the rifle responded with a metallic click. I brought the weapon to my shoulder, aiming down the iron sights into the darkness. Just sit and breathe. If I played this right, I might be able to get to the station. Down the alleyway, the Adlet's shadow betrayed its stealthy approach. This was too soon. I hadn't expected it to be this close already. There was only one way in and one way out. If I tried to run now, the beast would catch me before I reached the next street. I pulled my sweater over my nose, trying to conceal my breath. There was a good chance it might not see me and turn back. With the rifle at the ready, I sat still as the Adlet stepped out into the alleyway. It sniffed the air, looking at the ground. It hadn't seen me yet, but it was getting closer. I wanted nothing more than to crawl inside myself and disappear. The creature was only 10 feet away when it raised its head and looked directly at me. With a squeeze of the trigger, the M16 roared to life, unleashing its rapid burst of firepower. The deafening crack of each shot resonated through the desolate alley. The muzzle flash illuminated the area for a split second, revealing swirling snowflakes dancing in the night. The recoil kicked up, but I held firm as hot brass kicked into the icy air. I swept the rifle from side to side, sending a stream of lead tearing into the Adlet. I couldn't make out where I had hit it, but I knew it was wounded. As the last round was expelled, the bolt locked to the rear. As if rehearsed, I dropped the weapon and disappeared into the shadows, leaving behind only the echo of gunfire in the frigid night. Part 6. I crouched low, my leg numb as I struggled through the frozen streets. Gust of chilled wind hammered the town in a torrent of unrelenting snow and ice. I knew the Adlet was still out there, wounded and angry. A force of murderous intent that couldn't be reasoned with. The soft glow of the station's exterior lights was a feeble beacon of hope, its promise of refuge growing stronger with each step. The door was ajar, and a sense of foreboding clung to it like a shroud. Had the creature beat me here? I had no choice. I was freezing, and my heart wouldn't stand much more. I eased the door open, the rusty hinges protesting with a low creak. The waiting room revealed a ghostly stillness. A place that, not more than an hour ago, held George, Mike, and Usak. Despite the open door, the station was warm, and I could already feel the tips of my fingers swelling. I secured the entrance, latched the deadbolt, and then lowered the blinds of the two front windows. My senses remained on high alert. The Adlet could emerge any time. I knew I had little time to gather myself. With great effort, I reached the nearest wall radiator, removing my gloves and warming myself. The tips of my pinky and ring finger on my right hand were gray. I was pretty sure I'd be losing them in the future. I didn't even want to think about my toes. Time seemed to stretch into a torturous eternity as I stood, allowing the heat to warm my body. For a moment, I drifted into unconsciousness, still pressed against the radiator and wall. I was exhausted. Every fiber of my being wanted to lie down and sleep. It hurt to move and to breathe. I was at the finish line. It was safe here. I could ride out the storm until morning. Suddenly, the low rap of a drum seemed to originate from within the station itself. Ba-dum. 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 The beat quickens as if matching my heartbeat. Ba-dum. 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 My gaze darted around the dim corners, trying to pierce the shadows that concealed the menace. I had led the Adlet back to the station, and it was now hunting me in the very place I thought would provide refuge. Ba-dum. Then as the drum beat reached its peak, it suddenly went silent. I pressed against the wall, a trickle of cold sweat running down my back. This was all a trap. I'd been too cold and exhausted not to recognize it. For Christ's sake, it even left the door open for me. From down the hall, the Adlet emerged with a sinister grace, its massive form towering menacingly in the dim light. Its fur was caked with dried blood, its claws scraping the walls with a sickening sound, leaving trails of splinters and wallpaper. It cast the flesh drum aside and moved into full view of fluorescent lights. I barely had time to react before the creature pounced, its speed defying its frame. With a brutal swipe of its paw, it sent me soaring across the room, landing on a set of chairs, my back cracking. Excruciating pain coursed through me. I couldn't stand, so I crawled. Behind me, heavy, deliberate steps followed. It was toying with me, taking its time. A firm claw grabbed my right leg, flipping me onto my back. It squeezed tight, dragging me back into the hallway. My duty belt brushed up against my stomach, reminding me that I still had my service weapon. I reached down, unclipping the holster and withdrawing the revolver. The Adlet stopped mid-stride, looking at the pistol. Without aiming, I pulled the trigger in rapid succession, emptying the gun. The first rounds hit center mass, having little effect, but the last round caught the creature's eye, causing it to let go. I scrambled away, retreating down the hall in the direction of the armory. Luckily, I hadn't locked the door. Finding the light on and the crate of white phosphorus grenades still on the gun table, I grabbed one, using my teeth to tear the cardboard packaging off. Down the hallway, the Adlet galloped, reaching me just as I slipped the safety pin off the grenade. It slammed me against the wall, smashing a hole through the paneling, sending splinters of wooden insulation drifting in the room. Then it hurled me back out of the armory, headfirst into the wall radiator. I felt the sharp metal dig into my brow as warm blood stung my eyes. I lay on the carpeted floor, dazed from the blow. I was quickly running out of options. My next move would be a gamble, but I couldn't let the beast walk out of here alive. Slowly, I slipped the handcuffs from my belt as the creature stood over me. Summoning the last dregs of my resolve, I hooked the cuff around the adlet's ankle. The creature looked confused, but then I jerked with all my might, connecting the other end of the radiator pipe. The beast bit down into my ribs with its powerful jaws, lifting me off the floor. A sickening crack followed as sharp teeth pierced my ribs. My body spasmed uncontrollably, and warm, sticky urine flowed down my pants leg. I could feel my heart giving out as pain overloaded my brain. With a final act of desperation, I released the grenade safety lever, dropping it to the floor. The beast swung me free from its mouth, jerking its leg and ripping the radiator from the wall. It went to run away from the bomb, but it remained tethered to the piping. The grenade exploded, engulfing the beast in white, searing phosphorus. It shrieked, trying to free itself, the whole way disintegrating into a fiery maelstrom. Heat soared through the waiting room, igniting paper and wood instantly. The station became a giant tinderbox as flames lashed about and billowing clouds of black toxic smoke rose to the ceiling. I crawled toward an office window, pulling myself up with what remained of my strength. I pressed against the glass, busting it free with my weight and falling to the snowy ground below. The world outside spun as I lay amidst the wreckage. My body trembled, the metallic taste of blood choking me. Floating embers from the fire twirled about. The storm had broken, replaced with a clear starry sky above. I could feel warmth settling into my bones, pain waxing away. I was dying. In the distance, the sounds of a snowcat grew louder by the moment. I faltered, my consciousness giving in. My eyes grew heavy with each labored breath. I could hear the soft rhythmic beats of a drum call to me, beckoning me to join it.
That was The Beast Portsmouth by Shane H. Sellers, as performed by Nick Goroff. And if you ask me, freezing to death sounds a lot better than what happened to the poor souls in that story. The cold doesn't bite like that thing does. The wind doesn't whisper your name in the dark. And whatever waits beyond the snowdrifts, well, let's just say it doesn't leave tracks you can follow. Shane H. Sellers is no stranger to gripping atmospheric horror, and his talent for crafting tension makes his work unforgettable. If you enjoyed tonight's tale, be sure to check out more of his work. Just search for him by name in your favorite search engine. You'll also find more of his work here on Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, including Shelter Games and Something Ate My Work Crew at the old Reed Place. And with that, dear listeners, our journey through fire and ice comes to a close. But something tells me these stories will stick with you long after the heat fades and the frost melts. If tonight's stories left you sweating, shivering, or both, consider supporting Chilling Tales for Dark Nights by leaving us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to the show. And if you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. It's the best way to keep the nightmares coming. For those of you who just can't get enough horror, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and become a patron. For as little as $7.99 a month, or even less with an annual subscription, you'll gain access to exclusive ad-free content, early releases, and stories too chilling for the public feed. And don't forget to follow us on social media for behind-the-scenes updates, community discussions, and more. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and X, where we keep the horror alive, even when the stories end. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and as always, it's been a pleasure creeping into your ears. Tune in every Monday and Wednesday for more terrifying tales, where we'll once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Until next time, sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.